ribbon cutting is just the beginning. Because whether the office owners and operators or even the occupants, big corporate occupiers, realize it or not, employees are the new consumers. And therefore, the office space that's being provided needs to be thought of more as experiential or hospitality than the old cubicle farm.
Hi, I'm Gordon Lamphere, and welcome to Real Finds, the podcast where we interview key entrepreneurs, activists, and researchers shaping the real estate industry and, as a result, our world. On today's podcast, we chat with Joe Brady. Joe's a commercial real estate veteran with extensive real estate experience in both the office and retail space. This is included, but not limited, to serving as CEO of the Americas for the Instant Group, and serving as head of real estate for Walgreens. On the podcast today, we discuss the evolution of retail compared to office, steps to building healthy businesses and business communities, and rethinking metrics for workplace performance. And most importantly, the keys to building the workplace of the future based around effective principles and behavioral economics. It's well worth a listen. Hey, Joe, thanks for hopping on the podcast today.
Hey, Gordon, great to be with you. Thanks.
So for any of the listeners that don't know you, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Yes. I've been in the commercial real estate business for 35 years. I really grew up on the retail side and worked literally every chair at the table in terms of development. So I've been an advisor, a developer. I've been in-house as the head of real estate at Walgreens. And so I've been part of some of the largest retail rollouts. And so really, I've taken that experience. And the last couple of years, I've been focused on office. And I joined a company called the Instant Group in December of 2019, thinking the notion of flexibility was on trend. Little did I know, with the pandemic, it became truly on point. And so I worked through the pandemic, focused on flexible office. And really, once the pandemic came to an end, it was really clear to me that that the office asset class was having a retail asset class moment. And so I felt like I had seen this movie already. And I really was curious about the underlying elements that contributed. And it really gave me the impetus to dive in and do a bunch of research and write a book.
So we're going to get back to your book, but what do you think those underlying elements are?
Yeah, I think two key elements, accelerating technology and changing consumer behavior. The iPhone, believe it or not, was only released in 2007. That was not that long ago. And yet, if you think about the impact that this little box has had on our lives, a lot of it's been good, but a lot of it's been bad, too. And there's some societal issues that, you know, we can talk about. But from a consumer behavior perspective, what we saw is the idea of a shop moving from four walls, a physical store, place you went to spend money when you bought something, to actually an active verb, a thing we did, irrespective of place. Now, we still went into Best Buy and we probably used our phone and we took pictures and we checked out prices and we're also able to have the liberty to buy and shop anytime, anywhere, have things delivered to our homes, have it delivered to a store, we could pick it up. And so this idea of what's generally called omnichannel retail or e-commerce has really emerged from an idea to a reality, to the point now where if you think about the total retail sales in the United States, it's over $3 trillion. E-commerce now represents somewhere between 15 and 17% of that. And it's pretty much stayed there through the pandemic and has showing no signs of retreating. Now, there were there was clickbait back in the day that there was the death of brick and mortar, right? No one would ever go to a store again. We would all be like that character in WALL-E. I don't know if you ever saw that movie, but you know, just sitting in our Barca loungers drinking big gulps and stuff just came to us. And part of the myth there was that we're tribal beings, we're social beings as humans, we want to interact. And what's interesting is the Gen Z population is actually back in retail stores at a level seen similar to what baby boomers did. And so we just know now that this consumer behavior change continues at pace. The retailers who have acknowledged what changing tastes mean have continued to do quite well. Those that haven't have become irrelevant. And what you really have are these consumers voting with their wallets to determine which retailers are relevant, which are not. And we've seen, a dustbin of lots of bankrupt retailers that just haven't cut it. And so the technology, and we can go deep into that, but I would say really this changing consumer is vitally important. Technology has also helped change what our expectations are. And with a company like Apple, and we talked about the iPhone, now that they are one of the most successful brick and mortar retailers out there as well. So much so that when malls report sales on a per square foot basis, it's with and without Apple, because Apple's per square foot sales are usually so high, right? So ex Apple, we're doing this. But if you think about what Apple did, it created a place of gathering with purpose and meaning, and it was multidimensional. You could go to learn. You could go to have questions answered at the Genius Bar. You know, people lined up out, for hours, even camped overnight to get a new release of an iPhone or an iWatch or something, an Apple Watch. It's just astounding what some of these retailers have been able to do, because they understand that consumers today want purpose, meaning, and connection with a brand.
Well, I actually love the chapter that you talked a lot about Apple and kind of how they design things. And I definitely want to have a callback to that later on in the interview to see kind of what we can learn from that as folks who might be involved in office or other asset classes that might be more employee-driven. I'm curious, what ultimately, though, inspired the book? Because I know there's a lot of writers that are looking at what we're seeing going on in the office market and our real shift towards, I don't want to say a better office, but certainly a different office. And what ultimately inspired your book when you started this process?
And Gordon, as we've talked, I spent 30 years in Chicago. I love the city. I've been to every nook and cranny of the city, and my retail experience certainly is head of real estate at Walgreens, and I've been involved in the civic fabric of the city. And so literally it's, my adopted hometown, and I love it. I'm also seeing tremendous struggles that parts of the city are having, including the Loop. So ultimately for me, I really, and this has been an exploration, I didn't have this thought when I wrote the book, but having written the book and now that I'm out speaking about it, it's really about building healthy communities. And I've really noticed how when you look at the Loop, for instance, the Central Business District, and forever CBDs were the vibrant beating heart, right? That was led by work in the office buildings. Retail and ancillary food and beverage was there to support work. But what we're seeing now is that monolithic view of just work, absent of live, work, and play, is leading to some disastrous results in cities like Chicago, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., San Francisco in the financial district, parts of New York, although New York is an outlier and is extremely resilient. But we're also seeing places like Seattle, L.A., downtown L.A., Portland, and so forth, where the central business district that has heretofore been reliant on predominantly the work rather than the live, work, play, healthy ecosystem is really suffering. Now, we also have some other cities, and I call out Detroit because believe me, Detroit got down to rock bottom. It got to the point where residential lots were being valued at a higher rate for them to be agriculture than residential, right? And Dan Gilbert of Rocket Mortgage with his development company Bedrock came in. Now, not every city is going to have an entrepreneur that can put $5 billion at work, but he did for his hometown of Detroit, and it's been extraordinary to see what's happening there. In another example, we're seeing a healthy community emerge in what was downtown Tampa, which really was an afterthought, right? And Jeff Vinnick, formerly of Magellan Funds at Fidelity, came in with Cascade Development, which is Bill Gates' investment fund, and really envisioned a whole new downtown Tampa. It's generally referred to as Water Street. And what we're seeing is better business districts, BBDs, not CBDs. Better business districts make sense because they have the live, work, play component, the 24/7, 365 component. And in Chicago, Gordon, as you know, if you go a mile and a half west of the Loop, you're in the Fulton Market area, which is a beautiful example of a better business district. Google is there. You have McDonald's World Headquarters. I put a Walgreens in the McDonald's World Headquarters building. CVS went in. You've got grocers. You've always had the hip and cool loft and residential. You've always had great restaurants, and now you have amazing hotels. Nobu opened there. The Hoxton is super cool. And so that's just a stark contrast of live, work, play, better business district, healthy community compared to that monolithic Loop, which now Google is trying with the State of Illinois building and restructuring that. But, you know, in Cranes this week, there's a whole article that literally lit up every single building in the Loop that's either in foreclosure or on a watch list. And so a lot's happening there. So really the impetus is to say, we have a slow moving car crash coming in the office asset class. 50% of existing office space is coming to expiry at the end of 2025. There's $2 trillion worth of mortgage debt against that office space. So we really haven't seen the beginnings of how bad the office market can get. I'm just raising my hand saying this is one man's observation, and we should be thinking about what it means. I just saw where the mayor of Chicago has a hiring freeze. He's laying people off. I mean, right now, more than ever, we need a private-public partnership that can come in and start shoring up our world-class cities.
So in terms of shoring up our world-class cities, one of the biggest things that we can do is try to look at the office market and what is really a sore spot in the commercial real estate world right now. And I'm curious, because you talk a lot about how retail survived what many people thought was a fatal blow in the mid-2000s and early 2010s. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, what do you think the biggest similarities are between the office and the retail world? Because that's certainly probably the closest tie we can do across asset classes.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's this notion of obsolescence, and I don't think it's necessarily fair to say with a broad stroke, the office asset class is going to fail. The obsolete and irrelevant parts of the office asset class are likely going to fail. Jeff Blau from Related Companies was just on CNBC, and what he was talking about is, you know, at Hudson Yards, they're 100% leased, right? If you go to the SL Green building in New York City, One Vanderbilt Place, built right next to Grand Central Station, it's 100% leased at $275 a square foot. There are amenities there. People want to be there. The problem, and I'll use New York as an example, 75% of the office stock was built before the IBM mainframe. That's 1964. These are 60-year-old buildings, which are functionally obsolete, that have, in many respects, floor plates that are way too big to be converted into residential. So you can open an urban brewery, you can open a vertical farm, but you're not converting it to residential. And for the most part, you're probably going to have to scrape and rebuild, which, you know, for those that own these buildings, they don't want to hear that. But we already saw this in the retail industry. You mentioned that, Gordon. And in the last 10 years, there's been over 100 million square feet of retail taken out of the supply equation. So you've seen whole malls just completely demolished and replaced with hotels and mixed use developments. You've seen the anchors of some of these malls, think the old Sears boxes or the old JCPenney boxes, that have been converted into multifamily. They've been converted into Lifetime Fitness locations. They've been converted into flexible office space. So you've started to see this, you know, this creative destruction happen in retail, and it's been going on for over 10 years, and you know it still hasn't settled. But what the relevant retailers have done is they've done a better job of listening to their consumers. The consumers are telling us everything we want to hear. The big question is, are we listening? And on the problem the office asset class has is it's fat, dumb, and stupid. It basically said, ribbon cutting, our job's done. And I argue ribbon cutting is just the beginning, because whether the office owners and operators or even the occupants, big corporate occupiers, realize it or not, employees are the new consumers. And therefore, the office space that's being provided needs to be thought of more as experiential or hospitality than the old cubicle farm where we just showed up at our assigned station and our middle manager was looking at us. And because we were sitting there, we were deemed being productive, which was a tremendous fallacy. So there's a lot of things happening here. One, we're in the new collar economy where technology has untethered us from the industrial era construct of going to a factory 9 to 5, Monday through Friday, which is what the modern office turned into. And we have to be more creative in how office space is used for the workplace, where work gets done. Is it necessary to be in an office every day for 8 hours or 9 hours? For some jobs, yes. And for some professions, yes. But for a vast majority of, call it the knowledge economy that's engaging in the keyboard economy, they can probably, and they are, voting with their feet right now. And we're seeing Mondays and Fridays super low. And we're seeing this curve go Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. So there has to be this mandate for leadership to help orchestrate the purposeful presence of people coming into an office, as opposed to passive attendance. I'll go back to another New York example. And in my previous role, we did research that concluded that if you lived in Westchester County and commuted into Midtown Manhattan, on average, you would spend $8,000 after tax in commuting and food and so forth. More importantly, you'd spend at least 2 hours a day. That's 10 hours a week of your time that you could be spending with your children, with your partner, you know, any of a number of things, sleeping in, meditating, exercising. I mean, there's a whole host of things from, a life and a work balance that could be factored in. And since the pandemic is eased, we have people that are making that trade. They're saying, listen, if I'm going to get on the train and go into Midtown, if I'm going to be in, you know, the western suburbs of Chicago and get on a metro and come into the loop, there better be a really good trade. There better be a purpose for me to do that. If I'm just going to go in so someone says, oh, I'm glad, Gordon, and glad, Joe, that you're in the office and you're on Zooms all day, that's not smart. Now, we have to get together. There is the collaboration, the culture, but I don't think you need to be in 5 days a week in order to maintain culture. I'll tell you what will crush culture is a mandate for you to be in. That's just a neon sign saying, we don't trust you. You were hired as an adult, but I'm treating you like a child. And I think companies have to start to, from the office side, get away from the management aspect and really start more of a leadership approach as to why people should come together. We use the term on-site is the new off-site. And I really like that because that means your time is respected and there are curated events that happen. There's a social, hopefully a social aspect where everyone comes together. As we've seen e-commerce and hybrid retail get to about 15 to 18%, we're going to likewise see hybrid work happening about the same level, if not more. And by the way, we're all the same humans. We're the same people who are voting with our wallet and how we spend our money, voting with our feet and how we make our money.
So I wanted to touch on what you mentioned earlier. We've had a number of folks that are involved in psychology and a couple of folks that have definitely touched on behavioral economics before talk about kind of the office as a service nowadays, which is a very different thing than what many of the investors I've worked with in the past typically saw office as, which was, as you put it, you build it and someone occupies the space, maybe you move a couple walls around, but that's really primarily what you're doing, at least up until the last maybe 5 years. And I'm curious, how would you characterize office today? And could you touch on it kind of from the perspective of consumer primacy, which is, I think, a very important case study that you talk about in your book?
Yeah, thanks for that. And I spent some time digging deep into behavioral economics. Sounds funny from a retail real estate guy with a degree in electrical engineering, but I wound up, like most people, reading and seeing the movie Moneyball. But what I found most interesting, and I love Michael Lewis, was a response to that movie. Which, if you haven't read it or haven't heard about it, it's a book called The Undoing Project. And Lewis tells a story about the reviews that he was getting from his book Moneyball, which, of course, was about Billy Beane and the Oakland A's and, you know, eliminating biases and focusing on data. And what came out of it, though, was a very interesting abstract that came from a guy named Richard Thaler and another guy named Cass Sunstein. Thaler is a Nobel laureate from the University of Chicago. His buddy Sunstein is a professor at Harvard Law School. And they talked about how, clearly Lewis was channeling the works of Danny Kahneman and Amos Tversky, and Lewis had no idea who those guys were and had no idea what these guys were talking about. And so it led him to his next book, which he wound up writing, and it's called The Undoing Project. It's a beautiful book. If you haven't read it, highly recommend it. And from there, it started this journey. And to really understand, if we're talking about consumer primacy, then we have to start thinking about behavioral science. And then we have to think about this extension in terms of behavioral economics. And there's a couple of things that have emerged. If you think about traditional architecture in the United States, trad architecture, it's a $50 billion a year industry. And yet, if you ask any of your friends or anyone if they know what the choice architecture is, they'll probably look at you sideways and have literally no idea what you're talking about. But part and parcel to the work that Thaler and Sunstein have done since the founders is really work through nudges. And I'm holding up a book called Nudge, the final edition. It's Thaler and Sunstein. And they go on to talk about, obviously, the basics of behavioral economics, which are biases and heuristics and how the mind thinks. Kahneman wrote a book called Thinking Fast and Slow, right? Gordon, if I ask you what's 1 + 3, you know, your fast brain just says, this is what it is. It's 4, right? But if I say, you know, what's 2,422 divided by pi? Well, like our fast brain doesn't process that. So nudges are something that are very interesting, right? So if you think about, let's talk about choice architecture. That is an environment in which we as people make decisions. And nudges become any adaptation of choice architecture that alters people's decision making. But here are the two really important points. One, it doesn't limit the individual and restrict them in any way. And two, it doesn't change their economic incentive. It's a role of a choice architect to create environments that will ultimately be beneficial for the individual. Now, what are some examples? Well, the most obvious one is a 401k, where and choice architecture would say, you know, Gordon and Joe show up, we show up to this Fortune 100 company, and in order to not participate in a 401k, we have to opt out. There's action that has to happen. But the choice architecture is such that we show up and all of a sudden we engage in a forced savings program that is painless. And oh, by the way, our employer matches it, right? So that's an example of choice architecture. Workplace professionals will need to think about what kind of nudges can be put in place. There's a fintech company, a payments company here in Jacksonville, Florida. And I met with the head of real estate one day, and he was so excited. And he said, hey, I had 85% attendance in the building today. And I said, oh, that's awesome. Tell me, how did you do it? And he said, well, I gave away AirPods. And I thought, oh, man. Okay. Well, so that was one day. One day makes not a trend. But if you think about other nudges, and I wrote a paper called The Nudge is Mightier Than the Mandate. And I think the challenge for corporate occupiers and even for building owners is to think about nudges that are such that people will want to show up and have that purposeful presence. You know, it could be anything from an intramural league where young people can socialize. It could be guest speakers. It could be any sort of level of curation. And we go through a lot of different examples of what these nudges are. But I think ultimately, if you subscribe to the construct that we're now engaged, that employees are the new consumers, we have to dig even deeper into what kind of nudges or what kind of environments can we create that will be good for them and good for the company and make everyone happy. So I think that's a big challenge.
So in terms of one of the biggest challenges you talk about in the book, it's kind of the idea of measuring goals. And I know that there's tons of clients I've worked with that have really struggled with this post-pandemic, where I have one client that had a report where they said, you know, do you feel like you've been more productive? And he sent it out to his employees, and 95%+ of his employees came back and said, yes, I've been more productive at home. And then he looked at billable hours, and billable hours were down. So, and I know that there are certainly examples to the contrary, where folks have talked about this in the Wall Street Journal, where they've put out polls and managers feel that people aren't as productive, but then you look at results and results are better at home. So I'm curious, you mentioned productivity and effectiveness a lot in the book and talking about trying to gauge results as an employer. Can you speak a little bit about that? Because I think that's a unique thing that we're kind of getting into now, entering this post-COVID age.
Sure. And in addition to the research that you mentioned, Gordon, Microsoft has a very widely generated and dispersed research piece on 20,000 individuals at Microsoft. And it's really about the productivity paradox, where the employees, 80-85% of the employees said that they were redlining. They were, you know, working harder than they've ever worked. And yet management of those employees, 85% said they didn't trust this whole hybrid work and didn't think people were working that hard. We've got a problem there, right? And I think, and it goes hand in glove, leadership and management versus effectiveness and productivity. I think managers are driving productivity. If we're in the manufacturing industry, we want to be productive, right? If you're building cars, you want to be as productive as you can. The difference is oftentimes we have these conversations in a very reductive silver bullet perspective. Like there has to be one answer. And there could be groups within a company that can be untethered, that can be focused, could be fully hybrid or remote or come together periodically. But ultimately, if what you're doing is delivering results to the bottom line of the objectives of the company, what is the purpose and the objectives? A leader's job is to lay out that strategy and hire the right people and, you know, make sure the team is in place and then get obstacles out of their way so they can achieve that which is effective. If they were simply defining productivity as, I sent out 100 emails today, you know, and Gordon, you're my boss and you call me up. I'm like, hey man, I was busy today. I sent 100 emails. Were any of those effective? You know, comparing that with someone that may have sent 5 emails, 4 of which have, you know, created a positive result to the bottom line. So I think we have to look at metrics a little bit differently. Productivity is an industrial era construct. And so much of the office and work right now is anachronistic, right? You know, we learned and started working in the fields, and then we went to the factory, and then, you know, the office building emerged. And as technology decided, you know, as technology continued on Moore's Law, now near exponential curve, it's really rattling a lot of our old, our old ways of work. And we're trying to figure out the new ways. And in many respects, we're doing it, we're flying the plane while we're, you know, reading the manual. And that's not always a safe thing to do. So I do think there's a high degree of confusion by a lot of corporates trying to figure out kind of who's in charge. You know, you have HR over here, IT, you have a corporate real estate department, which, and everyone's sort of pointing at each other saying, well, aren't you supposed to be running this whole workplace thing? And so there's probably, and there is emerging this new school of thought that the workplace experience executive is at a chief level, because before HR generally was responsible for the biggest cost in the company, right? People. The real estate guy is probably the second biggest cost in, you know, Fortune 100, Fortune 500. And IT has a big budget too. But you have these things totally separated. But in a hybrid world, now you have, you know, you have all of that coming together. You know, people and places are coming together at random times. How do you build a healthy ecosystem of places for your most expensive, your costly, and valuable element, your people, to actually be as effective as they need to be? And so there's a lot of questions around that. A lot of questions around a hub and a spoke system, and, you know, the use of flexible office space to give the consumers, employees, options to go and test out if they like working in a northern suburb or a western suburb. And if you follow their behavior and measure where they're going and how often they're using space, you can get a better insight as to where your different satellite offices could or should be. But again, the ribbon cutting is just the beginning. It's not the end of the process. And so there has to be this ongoing monitoring and leadership.
So I think the hardest thing about the process is the leap of faith that many employers have to take. I know talking with so many of my clients, it's been very difficult for many employers to take that absolute leap of faith and kind of change things up. And I think one of the parts of the book that I really felt, because as somebody who consults people on a regular basis about what they're going to do with their future, loss aversion and risk aversion is such an important part of the human psyche. And I'm curious if you could kind of address how that's played out in the office world as well as the retail world, and how there's so many individuals that are decision makers who are kind of paralyzed by the fear of making a mistake.
Yeah, I mean, it goes to the failure culture or lack thereof, right? Where we know that we don't generally get rewarded for trying something and failing, unless you work for a really special company. The loss aversion is really, really powerful, right? I mean, we would rather, if we had $100, we had a chance, of winning 50 or losing 100. We're not taking that bet. We're just going to keep the 100, right? I mean, because of the loss aversion, we know that the pain of losing is twice, 2x greater than the gain of winning. And so I think there's a couple of things happening. One, you have employees who are now engaged in loss aversion, where they went from pre-pandemic work-life balance to an inversion of life work balance. And so now you're telling me I'm going to lose that? It's probably even more pronounced given that we're talking about people's families and their lifestyle and so forth. And I think in many respects, there's a seemingly loss of power from a manager's perspective. I call them Dilbert managers in the book, right? It's where's my red stapler? And unfortunately, there's a lot more work that needs to be done by leaders in companies to help make sure that sub leaders, not managers, are guiding their teams. What people don't work for a paycheck; they work for a purpose. They want to be associated with company that means something. And if they're just going to work for a paycheck, there are plenty of other places to go. Now, I know unemployment is super low, but if you have a set of skills and you can carry them elsewhere, you likely are going to. The loss aversion is a very big issue. Change management, as you know, Gordon, in your consulting practice, is one of the hardest things ever. Right. I mean, it's just people don't want to change. I'll give you an example of JP Morgan. JP Morgan has call centers all over the world. They have a 2 million square foot call center in the Phoenix market. And no one ever thought any of those people could actually work from home. And yet, for about 2 years, they did. The residential internet infrastructure held up. There were no violations of security or no hacks, no nothing. People worked from home. They were happy and they were more productive. We can use that productivity in a call center sense, which made JP Morgan say, maybe we don't need 2 million square feet. Maybe we need 1 million. Maybe we need 500,000. So, unless and until there's a shock to the system that almost forces people to pivot, the inertia of what we're experiencing. And again, between office and the retail asset classes, that's $7 trillion in inertia. It's really, really powerful. So we're talking about pretty major forces to try to disrupt that sort of movement, that continuation of movement. But we definitely saw a tectonic shift in the pandemic. And companies are going to continue to have to grapple with, you know, how to change, how to keep up, you know. And by the way, today's the slowest day of change for the rest of our lives, right? I mean, McKinsey is saying that by 2030, which isn't all that far from now, a little over 5 years, we'll have at least 5,000 quantum computers up and active. Now, there's a company called Atom Computing that is on the verge of introducing a 1,000 qubit quantum computer, which is 1 billion times more powerful than a classical computer today, right? So if we think NVIDIA is frothy and, you know, this whole thing and the whole AI boom is something, like, wait until quantum happens in 5 years. But if you think about it, if you and I went out and started a company, Gordon, and we were going to go and lease office space, we'd probably be asked to sign a 10-year lease. Yet between now, you know, halfway through our 10-year lease, the whole world's going to change again with quantum computing, right? So it's part of the need to build in agility and resiliency into these asset classes that's vital.
So for building agility for the future, let's get into our final four. Every podcast we do a final four questions. It's a great way to wrap things up. And I think these will work especially well given the topic. And the first question, talking about agility and the future, we always like to ask, where do you see real estate going then over the next 10 years? Because we have so much change, and certainly Moore's Law is going to drive change at an increasingly rapid rate, at least from the tech side. Where do you see things going over the next decade?
I'll go back to the economic philosopher Schumpeter about creative destruction, right? We will continue to see this creative destruction. We will see space that becomes functionally and technically obsolete that gets scraped and gets rebuilt. There will be more, you know, Hudson Yard is only halfway built. There will be more One Vanderbilts in New York. We saw Blackstone put almost $1 billion into the Willis Tower, the former Sears Tower, right? So this creative destruction will continue to happen. I think where the winners will find themselves are in healthy ecosystems, the better business districts that are the live, work, play. And the monocultures of just work and the anachronistic CBDs are going to feel an awful lot of pain before they rebound.
And then going and talking about things rebounding, one of the biggest things that we like to do is kind of take a leap back and leap back in our careers. And we have a lot of people that listen on the podcast. Probably about a quarter of them are brokers and real estate professionals that are probably under 30. And so one of the things we like to do is take that jump back and say, when you were starting out in the industry, if you could have given yourself 1 minute of advice, what would it have been?
I would have told myself to be more brave and reach out to more people. What I find now in this part of my career that, you know, I interact, I speak an awful lot and go to student groups, and I'm on the board at the University of Florida's real estate program. And I'm amazed at how many people don't take advantage of the opportunity to come up and talk to an old silverback about the industry and get advice. And the ones that do and who are prepared stand out mightily. It's almost like receiving a handwritten thank you note, where, you know, that, wow, that stands out now, doesn't it? And, you know, in a sense, Even if you're only supposed to be in an office 3 days a week, if you do show up 5 days a week, and we know in the real estate business, this is a pro tip for our young colleagues, stuff always happens on a Friday afternoon, right? So being there and being able to catch something becomes an outlier and gives you a competitive edge. So, you know, that's the first thing, though, would be to have more courage and gumption to go out and meet people and ask as many questions as possible and try to learn as much as I could.
That's a phenomenal answer. But we do have two more questions. And one of my favorite questions that we like to ask is about the whole idea of books. And I know you wrote a book, and we would highly recommend that. And we're going to put a link to that book in the comments under this podcast. But besides your book, what's a book that if someone's interested in real estate or office or the future of work, that someone should reach out and pick up a copy of?
That's an interesting one. I would. There's one that's a biography of Trammell Crow, the builder. Okay. It's one that I love and gone back to several times. You know, it's real easy to look at a developer, a visionary, a couple of decades in and say, you know, he kind of made it look easy. But this book really talked about the slings and arrows of how difficult the business can be sometimes. And so I find it helpful for myself and for recommending to young people to really understand this is hard and you're going to have some really bad days and you need to be resilient and you need to know that you can control only that which is controllable. And there's an awful lot that's uncontrollable. So, you know, I think there's a lot of life lessons learned in that. We all need to be a bit more resilient in, you know, how we bounce back. I always say there's 10,000 reasons why something can't happen. I just want the five. Let's figure out the five, how we can make this happen, right? And optimism can take you pretty far.
So optimism is great, and we're a very optimistic podcast. And one of the biggest ways that we look towards in an optimistic way is to get connection out of every podcast. And that's the whole philosophy behind the Real Finds podcast is we firmly believe that the men and women who are in the arena know the best connections to reach out to. And right. So in terms of that, we wanted to reach out and see who should be the next person we should invite on the podcast.
Ah, that's very interesting. I would recommend Walter Wahlfeldt from JLL. Wally Wahlfeldt. He's Chicago-based, based at the JLL headquarters. He leads the retail practice at JLL, and he has seen a dramatic change in the industry over the last 10 years or so. Can speak to some of the new trends. He's one of the leading voices in and around retail.
Well, we might even get to have him in the in the podcast studio as a Chicago-based individual. And so we'll reach out to him.
Excellent.
But before we go, we have one final question for you. And this is an important question. And it's, what's the best way for somebody who's interested in reaching out to you or learning a little bit more about your book to reach out to you?
Sure. I appreciate that. I have a webpage at joebrady.ai. My email is jb@joebrady.ai. The book workshop is available at Amazon. So hardcover, Kindle, soft cover, any sort of, I haven't done the audio version yet, but may. And I'd stop by the website and check it out. So I have articles I've written and presentations. I just got back from Latin America. I was in Chile and in Santiago and Lima at WorkTech speaking on this subject, and we'll have some excerpts there as well. So joebrady.ai.
Joe is a great read, and thank you very much for hopping on the podcast today. Thanks a lot.
Gordon, thank you.
Thanks again to Joe for coming on the podcast. If you enjoyed the podcast, please give us a like, a share, and especially a review. Reviews truly matter and help us continue to get quality guests. You can find us on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gordon Lampier with the Real Finds Podcast. Thank you for listening.